Mourning McCain in Vietnam, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Before becoming a politician, John McCain was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. He was tortured and beaten during his 5 years as a POW. Today in Vietnam, he's being remembered for his role later in life when he helped start a new relationship between Washington and Hanoi.
You had to be a big man to forgive and to push for something that's bigger than your own personal experience.
Plus, we'll hear about McCain's legacy on immigration and how his absence could derail future efforts to reach a compromise on the issue.
I think you could make the case that John McCain was the most committed Senate Republican to passing bipartisan immigration reform.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you here on this Monday. Civility, it is a concept you heard a lot about when John McCain spoke. The late Arizona senator wrote about civility in his recently published memoir, The Restless Wave.
Before I leave, I'd like to see our politics begin to return to the purposes and practices that distinguish our history from the history of other nations. I'd like to see us recover our sense that we are more alike than different.
Senator McCain reading there from his memoir, which was published after his brain cancer diagnosis just about a year ago. There have been many tributes to McCain since his death was announced on Saturday. In a moment, more about McCain's legacy regarding immigration, but we wanted to start with how McCain is being remembered today in Vietnam. As you probably know, McCain served as a Navy pilot during the Vietnam War until one day in 1967 when his plane was hit.
I ejected and broke my leg and both arms and went into a lake, parachuted into a lake. And I was picked up by some North Vietnamese and taken to the hospital where I almost died.
McCain there is speaking to his North Vietnamese captors not long after he was shot down. He remained a prisoner of war for 5 years. That clip featured in a 2008 documentary from PBS Frontline, produced by Vietnamese-American journalist Nguyen Quy Duc. Duc now lives in Hoi An in central Vietnam. Tell us, first of all, Duc, what the media in Vietnam have been saying about John McCain for the last 24 hours or so.
Well, the official newspapers, including Vietnam News, which is the national government-run English language daily, has been rerunning a lot of stories about John McCain, focusing on both his time in prison and his effort to renew relations along with John Kerry, that both were veterans who had come back and helped rebuild relationships with Vietnam despite their past. So that has been getting a lot of media time here.
And the tone, fairly praiseworthy, would you say?
Very praiseworthy, in fact. They don't tend to think of John McCain as the last Cold Warrior, very anti-communist. They never mention the stories about him calling the Vietnamese with derogatory terms like gooks. None of that has been seen in the media here, but mostly that he was treated well and he came out and he became a friend of the country that placed him in prison.
And I gather ordinary Vietnamese citizens also are paying their respects, yeah?
Yes, a lot of people around the lake, apparently, where he fell down, came down to lay some flowers. I mean, a few people have, and a few Americans have been gone there. There's a plaque there and a memorial sign there that talked about McCain being captured there. So that's getting some videos and some media attention, where he was shot down in 1967.
And what about McCain's actual captors? I gather they've been speaking out. What are they saying?
Well, they're saying that they admired him. They taught him English. They were friendly with him, and he was friendly. They're saying they keep memorabilia. Some of them have seen McCain when he came back to Vietnam in years later, and they talk about that, and they're being trooped out, and there's a bit of propaganda there. Yes. There are characters who have pat answers and very well-rehearsed lines about what they did, and those stories are being repeated again here and there, but more and more it's just about the U.S.-Vietnam friendship and cooperation with McCain's support. People are talking about that quite a lot.
Yeah, no doubt a little bit of a revisionist history there. So what was John McCain's role in reconciling Vietnam and the United States?
I think he led the delegations. He was part of Congress and the Senate to come over and push for open relationships with Vietnam, push for normalization, to negotiate with the Vietnamese about the fate of the missing in actions or MIAs, as it were, and demanding that Vietnam releases information and all of that in order to have rapprochement with the U.S. So he was key in those early years and pushing for better relations between Vietnam and the U.S. And McCain went against some of the thinking inside the U.S. in order to do this. And with his position as a former prisoner, he had gravitas to what he was saying.
So having produced this documentary for Frontline back in 2008, Duc, what's your takeaway of the legacy of John McCain?
Well, I think we begin to not so much make him a saint, but to know that he tried to be a statesman. And I think the one thing that I see now is that he made mistakes and he recognized how he had been making mistakes. And we Vietnamese appreciate the fact that, you know, you come out and admit your mistakes so that you can move on and learn from your lessons. That's very clearly something that's on our mind. And part of it is that we're sorry the war happened, that these circumstances happened where you were imprisoned, you were mistreated. But we recognize that you had to be a big man to forgive and forgo that, to want better relations with Vietnam and to push for something that's bigger than your own personal experience.
Journalist Nguyen Quy Duc in Hoi An, Vietnam, thank you very much for your thoughts today.
Thank you very much, Mark Holm.
The late Senator John McCain was also well known for his work on comprehensive immigration reform. He was not able to get a win for the cause, but it did win McCain praise for his dedication and reaching across the aisle. Jude Joffe Block is a reporter who has covered Arizona politics and the senator for years. She walked us through McCain's long history of immigration reform work in the Senate.
I think it's important to remember that McCain spoke passionately about border security, but also about the humanitarian issues around immigration reform. And he liked to say that he would keep a sign in his office that said, "Help wanted, Irish need not apply," to remind him of the anti-Irish sentiment that targeted his own ancestors. His contribution to the modern immigration debate began in 2005, really. And that's when House Republicans passed a controversial immigration bill known as the Sensenbrenner Bill. And it was very harsh on undocumented immigrants. It made it a felony to be in the country without papers. And at the same time, a bipartisan group in the Senate started working together to create an alternative bill on immigration that would be completely different. And two of the leaders on that effort in the Senate were John McCain from Arizona and the late Ted Kennedy, a Democrat from Massachusetts. And together, they created a bipartisan framework on immigration reform. It included border enforcement, guest worker visas, sanctions on employers who hired undocumented workers, and a path to citizenship for people in the country without papers. The bill ultimately failed in 2006, but that framework really kept reappearing in slightly different forms. So they tried again the following year, but it failed in 2007. And then again in 2013, after Kennedy had passed. But all three times, really, it was House Republicans that killed the effort. And that was a great frustration to John McCain.
How did McCain's position on immigration play out in his home state of Arizona?
Yeah, well, that relationship between McCain and Republicans in his home state is really interesting because on the one hand, he was reelected over and over again by Arizonans. But there was a tense relationship. There were many vocal Arizona Republicans who would call him a rhino, a Republican in name only. And a big reason for that was his stance on immigration, which they saw as a betrayal. But, you know, at the same time, he was popular in his own way and did continue to get reelected. And in his book, In the Restless Wave, he talks about how he didn't give in to those loud anti-immigrant voices. He cited polling data that showed that Americans and Arizonans as a whole generally supported immigration reform. Though at the same time, there have been moments when some people would argue McCain did flip-flop on the immigration issue, especially in election years. Mm. So in 2008, he ran for president as the Republican nominee. Some people would argue he didn't champion comprehensive immigration reform much in that campaign season. And then in 2010, he had a primary challenger from the right, and McCain tried to position himself as more of a hardliner on border policy.
Yeah, we actually have a clip from that 2010 TV ad where he kind of presents himself as tough on illegal immigration. Let's hear that.
Drug and human smuggling, home invasions, murder.
We're outmanned. Of all the illegals in America, more than half come through Arizona.
Have we got the right plan?
Plan's perfect. You bring troops, state, county, and local law enforcement together.
And complete the dang fence.
It'll work this time. Senator, you're one of us.
Yeah, he sounds like Donald Trump in some ways there. He's speaking with a local sheriff in Arizona. Jude, you can actually find that spot from 2010 on YouTube. And one comment from 3 years ago goes, "What a load of blank. John McCain is all for amnesty. He's never had a stance against illegal immigration. He is desperate and should disappear." So who was the real John McCain when it came to immigration reform?
Well, I think given that in his book, Restless Wave, which was kind of his farewell to the country, I think given how passionately he wrote about immigration reform and the need for it, I think we can trust that that was the position he wants to be remembered for. And even after that ad came out, the one that we just heard, he did work with the, quote, Gang of Eight, that bipartisan group of senators in 2012 and 2013 to try to pass another immigration reform push. So he did return to his original position on comprehensive immigration reform. And in his book, he writes, "I'd like to say I'll try again," speaking about immigration reform, but he knew time was running out. And he wrote that that was a harder defeat for him than most others because so many Americans want immigration reform passed, and he felt it was so badly needed.
McCain had a famously bad relationship with President Trump. Trump shocked many McCain supporters in 2015 by saying McCain was a war hero because he was captured and Trump prefers people who weren't captured. Trump also, noticeably, was not invited to McCain's funeral. But during the presidential primaries, McCain did vow to support Trump if he became the nominee. I'm just wondering how that played among his largely Latino constituency.
Yeah, well, that election season, there was an interesting thing that came out. Someone taped some comments that McCain made candidly during a fundraiser talking to donors. And he said how very worried he was that Trump's candidacy was alienating Latinos. And he said something like during his time in the Senate, he hadn't seen his Hispanic constituents so upset. And ultimately, of course, McCain announced, you know, a month before the election that he would not vote for Trump. And he also ended up easily winning his own reelection bid that November.
So what does McCain's passing mean, Jude, for the future of the Republican Party on immigration reform and actually any hope of immigration reform, considering, his strategy was working across the aisle? And that doesn't seem like a very common strategy these days.
No, it really is not. And I think you could make the case that John McCain was the most committed Senate Republican to passing bipartisan immigration reform. The climate is more polarized than ever, and it's unclear who's going to really pick up the mantle.
Jude Joffe Block is a reporter in Phoenix. She has covered Arizona politics and John McCain for years. Thanks very much for your time today, Jude.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It happened in Europe a few years back when hundreds of thousands of migrants from Syria, Afghanistan, and Eritrea began landing on shores there. Open doors, lots of people coming in, and then suddenly, not so many open doors, more restrictions, in fact. We now have, in this hemisphere, a pattern of migration out of Venezuela that follows a similar story. Since the economic crisis began to engulf Venezuela a few years ago, many there have fled the country. And just in the past year, the number of Venezuelans abroad has increased dramatically. The UN estimates that 2.3 million Venezuelans have fled for Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil, and Peru. Just this past Friday, authorities in the Peruvian capital Lima began enacting tighter entry requirements. Simeon Tagel is a foreign correspondent based in Lima. Just remind us, first of all, Simeon, why we are seeing such an increase in Venezuelans seeking asylum.
Well, Venezuela is in complete economic and democratic meltdown. The country has hyperinflation. The IMF estimates it will hit or could hit 1,000,000% this year. Basic foodstuffs, everything from bread and rice to chicken, but also medicine, whether it's aspirin or cancer medicine, you name it, you can't get it. People are hungry. They're starving in many cases. And I think this wave of migrants is it's not people that want to leave their country. It's people that have no choice.
So on Friday, tell us what happened. What are these new requirements in Peru?
So the Peruvian government is clearly worried about the number of Venezuelans in Peru now. The figure is thought to be 400,000. But what was a steady trickle and then a steady stream has in the last couple of months turned into a torrent. On one day in June, 5,000 Venezuelans on a single day entered the country. Most Venezuelans, or many Venezuelans who've arrived in Peru, have done so using an identity card rather than a passport. But the government decided that it was no longer going to allow that and that only Venezuelans with passports would be allowed in.
So are these new requirements in Peru, is it specific to Venezuelans, or will other South Americans also need to present a passport and follow these new requirements?
No, this is specific to Venezuelans, with the exception now of the elderly, pregnant women and children. So what it looks like is that the Peruvian government has sought to reduce the number of Venezuelans coming to Peru, but without actually taking the political blame for that. Because getting a passport in Venezuela, like pretty much everything else there, is a really difficult process. Apparently, it takes something like a year, and you have to pay bribes that for your average Venezuelan would be the equivalent of an arm and a leg.
So I know these new requirements only came into effect on Friday, but I mean, how are people thinking this might impact the whole region?
It seems to have already made a difference just in Peru. The number of Venezuelans who entered Peru on Sunday was just something like 1,500, whereas the day before, when you could still enter without a passport, it was more than twice that, something like 3,500. But foreign ministers from various South American nations are going to be meeting later this week to address the Venezuelan migration crisis. And everyone's pretty clear that there needs to be some kind of coordination at a regional level about to handle the Western Hemisphere's worst migration crisis in something like 50 years.
Correspondent Simeon Tagel speaking with us from Lima, the capital of Peru. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm going to make a pretty safe bet with you. Somewhere in the country right now, a theater company is performing a play by Neil Simon. Simon died over the weekend at the age of 91. He liked to write about strained relationships. His characters were usually battling alcoholism or depression or loneliness, but he would pepper his scripts with funny one-liners. I like to think of him as the Jewish Noel Coward with a humor that's more Borscht Belt than British upper crust. Here's Nathan Lane and Dan Castellaneta in The Odd Couple.
You still didn't fix the refrigerator? It's been 2 weeks now. No wonder it stinks in here.
Temper, temper. If I wanted nagging, I'd go back with my wife. I'm out. Who wants food?
What do you got?
I got brown sandwiches and green sandwiches.
Earlier today, I spoke with Mercedes Rule, who played Bella in Lost in Yonkers. I asked her about meeting Neil Simon for the first time.
I didn't meet him until the first audition for Lost in Yonkers. I was out in California. I was shooting Fisher King, and it was one of the last days, and I was called, and I was told that Neil Simon wanted to see me in 2 days for this play, Lost in Yonkers. So they sent me the play, and I looked at it, and I thought, huh, interesting, different. And then I thought, but what do I do with this character? Because she's a young woman in her 30s, but with the emotional development of a 13-year-old. And so I sat down, thought for a long time, and then, of course, I remembered the obvious. I had just done a few years before Big with Tom Hanks, and in that movie, he very successfully played a 13-year-old in a grown man's body. And what I remembered about it was He really sold the grown man as a 13-year-old. The only problem was when you arrived at a point where he had to demonstrate adult emotional maturity, a sense of experience that an adult has, he was lost. And I thought, that's how to do it. She's not stupid. She just doesn't have the emotional maturity of an adult. So I brought it into him the next day, and I was just so hoping he would think it worked too. And luckily, it did. It was like I had found a child of his that had gotten lost, and I found it and gave her back to him, you know, and it was delightful.
You know, I've been scratching my head since the news of Neil Simon's passing, how his plays are appreciated in other cultures. And in 2010, you were actually in a revival of The Prisoner of Second Avenue in London. I mean, how did that play resonate in London? What did British audiences make of Neil Simon, and, you know, coming with this story about a couple on the Upper East Side of Manhattan?
Yeah. And the guy is fired from his advertising agency, and he goes into a nervous breakdown. And it's very funny, but there's a part of it that's not funny.
Did the audiences in London think it was funny? I mean, were there reactions that you were not expecting?
There were mixed reactions at first, but I think eventually the audiences that came with an understanding and consequently were able to savor Neil.
I know, Mercedes Ruehl, you're a born and bred New Yorker, but not from the same Jewish New Yorker background Neil Simon had. So you're kind of an observer of all these cultures. You're there on the stage in London. What did the Brits not seem to get about this Jewish Noel Coward?
Good question. There is something, I think, of the American New York Jewish immigrant experience in all of its crazy funniness and all of its tragedy. You're coming from an entirely different sort of provenance than the Sceptred Isle.
Interestingly, though, Simon took Plaza Suite and came out later with California Suite, and in 1994, London Suite, kind of following the same formula of couples in and out of love, this time in a hotel overlooking Hyde Park. Do you think there was a universal quality to Neil Simon's stories?
Yeah. And it does have a lot to do with the search for love, the confounded and confounding search for love.
That's actress Mercedes Ruehl speaking with us about working with the late Neil Simon. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman. Still ahead on The World, Pope Francis is facing a challenge from a conservative Catholic archbishop who published a letter calling on the pontiff to resign. Francis doesn't appear to be worried.
From his comments on the plane last night to journalists, I think he's fairly relaxed about it. He knows that there's nothing in this letter, you know, which he has to be personally too worried about.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A former ambassador from the Vatican to the U.S. is calling on Pope Francis to resign over his handling of sexual abuse allegations. Carlo Maria Vigano says he told the Pope 5 years ago about sexual abuse allegations against a high-profile American cardinal, but nothing was done. Pope Francis is already facing scrutiny following a Pennsylvania grand jury report detailing clerical abuse spanning decades. Austin Ivory is based in London, where he's a commentator on affairs in the Catholic Church. He's also a biographer of Pope Francis. I asked him what he makes of Vigano's 11-page letter.
He's painting a picture of a generalized kind of corruption, and he's particularly concerned, almost obsessed, one would say, with homosexuality. But the real sting of the letter, and the reason why his supporters and the group that's behind this have got excited, is that he claims that in 2013 he told Pope Francis about the former Archbishop of Washington, by then very long retired, Theodore McCarrick, that there was a big file of allegations about McCarrick, and he claims that Pope Francis therefore must have known that and basically did nothing about it.
Now, Pope Francis has not officially responded to these allegations, but challenged reporters yesterday to judge these accusations for themselves, the implication being that the allegations are not valid. Now, I know that Vigano has criticized Francis in the past, but what kind of concerns have the Pope's supporters raised about Vigano's credibility?
Well, I think that what they're saying is, look, first of all, this is a man with a long history of making allegations. In 2012, when he worked in the Vatican, he was basically sacked from the Vatican and sent to the United States as a diplomatic representative. And he made all kinds of claims back then, which, frankly, many of which really didn't stand up to scrutiny. And I think what the basic reservation people have about this letter is that here is a man who has opposed Pope Francis from the beginning, who objects to many of his teachings, who is part of a traditionalist group within the church, which really dislikes the Pope. And, you know, the fact that the letter ends with this call for resignation, you just think, well, okay, his motives here are suspect. Obviously, a lot of what he says is certainly interesting to a church observer like me. I'm not saying that it's all rubbish, but I think the way it's put together is ultimately unpersuasive.
Given all that, though, what does this letter and the reaction to it in the Vatican tell us about what's going on within the Catholic Church?
Well, it says two things, really. One is that people are very upset about these revelations concerning the former Archbishop of Washington. And they're absolutely right to be concerned, because what we know is that this man got to be America's leading churchman under Pope John Paul II, even though people knew that this behavior was carrying on. Now, a lot of people are saying we need this investigated. And I think actually Pope Francis will investigate. From his comments on the plane last night to journalists, I think he's fairly relaxed about it. He knows that there's nothing in this letter, you know, which he has to be personally too worried about. And I think he sees it all as actually this stuff probably needs to come out. And I think over the next few years, we're going to see it. There's a lot of anger out there, a lot of indignation, particularly with bishops. You know, why didn't we know this? How did this happen? And I think these questions are going to have to be answered.
Well, Olsen, on the eve of the Pope's arrival in Ireland, we spoke with the founder of the Irish Protection Organization for Minors, One in Four, Maeve Lewis. That was on Friday. And I asked her if her disappointment is about Francis himself and the high hopes there were for him as Pope. I just want you to hear what she said.
When Pope Francis was elected, I think we all had high hopes that this papacy was going to be different, that he was going to really tackle vigorously the issue of child sexual abuse. He has been in office now for 5 years. Nothing has changed.
I mean, she did go on to say that Francis did establish the Commission for the Protection of Minors, but she also said it's toothless. Take away these allegations made by Vigano. What do you think about what Maeve Lewis said?
I just straightforward disagree with it. On the disciplinary front, the Pope has been vigorous in saying to bishops, look, if you cover up, if you fail to take action against an abusive priest in your ranks, you will have to stand down. Most of the allegations in Vigano's letter are really not about the sexual abuse of minors. They're about a kind of internal culture. We live now in a very different climate in the church, and I think this Pope has done a huge amount in that respect. But there's a huge amount still to be looked at and still to be gone over. This is an issue with which we as Catholics in the Catholic Church are going to have to live with for a long time. Pope Francis in Dublin, he said, you know, may we experience ever deeper shame about this. He's not running away from this. He wants to confront this. But it is an issue which is very, very, very complex, goes back a long way, and is going to take a generation to heal.
Writer and commentator Austin Ivory speaking with us from London. Thank you.
Thank you.
32 years later, the government in Ukraine is still cleaning up from the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Thousands of people died, nearly 100 Ukrainian villages were abandoned, and the total cost of the cleanup amounts to at least $700 billion. Our Cross Women's Lives reporter, Allison Herrera, was recently in Ukraine, and she met some of the women who are still living close to the crippled reactor, despite the risks.
Every day, one of the world's worst nuclear accidents is recreated over and over at the National Chernobyl Museum near the center of Kiev in Ukraine. It's a diorama that shows the reactor melting down with almost scary precision. All of a sudden, the room with the diorama gets really dark. Lights flash, alarms sound, and ominous music fades up as a dark cloud passes over the model in the diorama case. This model represents the exact moment on April 26, 1986, when the Chernobyl nuclear power plant exploded and clouds of radiation traveled over what was then a territory of the Soviet Union. The radiation killed thousands of people, and 92 villages nearby were permanently evacuated. The government spent billions of dollars to clean up after the disaster. A generation later, Ukraine is still dealing with the aftermath of this nuclear disaster. Now, there's a 1,000-square-mile area around the defunct plant, known as the exclusion zone, where people are forbidden to live. Even to this day, the government has teams of scientists who monitor the soil, vegetation, and wildlife for radiation, not only inside that exclusion zone, but outside of it as well. Who are these teams of scientists, and what exactly are they monitoring?
Kasparov Valery Alexandrovich, director of Ukrainian...
That's Valery Kasparov, introducing himself to me in Russian. He's the director of the Ukrainian Institute of Agricultural Radiology. You can almost hear the lab coat he wears from the tone in his voice. His office is in a group of gated Soviet-style laboratories about 83 miles from the abandoned villages that surround Chernobyl nuclear power plant.
Our institute was established a month after the Chernobyl accident because the main problem associated with the accident had to do with its consequences on agricultural production and training the rural population.
This area, known as the exclusion zone in Ukraine, was known for its fertile soil. Before the accident, it was called the breadbasket of Eastern Europe. People farmed this land, and it provided fields to feed people here in the former Soviet Union. And now it's deserted. Nobody's farming there anymore. It's dangerous to live there because it's still contaminated. That's Valentin Protsak. He's one of the researchers that works with Valery at the institute. We're standing in front of a map. He's showing me some spots outside the exclusion zone they've been monitoring. Some spots outside the exclusion zone have the same amount of dangerous radiation as those inside the zone. After all these years, people have been living in areas declared safe, but it might not be.
Once it became clear, it turned out that these areas were almost exclusively used as temporary encampments for military subunits.
32 years ago, when soldiers were cleaning up after the disaster, they stayed in small villages outside the exclusion zone. They tracked radioactive soil from their boots and vehicles. Valentin and his team are just finding this out. He said there's no official record of where the soldiers stayed, so researchers rely on help from villagers.
It is a 3-year project. Now in the second year of the project, we discovered such areas that you need to do something with them, or they should be removed from there and taken for disposal and burial.
So how do residents know they're living in one of these radiation hotspots? Spots where radiation may be just as high as near the reactor in Chernobyl? They don't. That's because researchers are still working on a map and their report about those hotspots. You can find a draft of that map on the wall of one of those laboratories, but it's doubtful residents living in those dangerous villages have ever seen it. So I drove to one of those villages to find out who might be living there. I brought along a Geiger counter. That's the beeping sound you hear in the background. It measures radiation. About a 2-hour drive from Kiev is the small, nearly abandoned village of Kropilka. It's one of those villages on the map that is considered a hotspot. It's also a 35-minute drive to Reactor 4 from here, but the exclusion zone is close by, about a mile away. It's here that I meet Nina, walking alongside the road.
How we lived in this place is how we continue to live. I cannot tell you more than that. I can't think about it anymore because my brain does not cook anymore.
Nina is 75 years old. A colorful headscarf covers her pulled back gray hair. As she wipes the dirt from her hands on her apron, she taps her metal bucket full of the bugs she pulled from her potato field, which is 2 feet away from where we stand talking. That contaminated soil soldiers tracked in from Chernobyl is the same soil where she's growing her potatoes today. All this time that Nina and I are talking about her potato field, the Geiger counter in my hand keeps beeping. Nina asked me if it was a phone. She'd never seen this instrument before, the instrument that measures radiation.
If you measure the field, will it beep? Let's go that way.
So I played scientist. I went out to the field and measured the radiation there. The beeping from the Geiger counter measures the amount of radiation present in the field. The more beeps you hear, the higher the levels of radiation are detected.
Tell her that we didn't hear anything, that they're fine.
For now, my amateur investigation finds that Nina just has a massive bug infestation. But the truth is, Nina says she was never worried, even after other neighboring towns were permanently evacuated. She's been here through the disaster, eating the same food and drinking the same milk, and she's still alive.
Перший рік нічого такого не відбувалося. Всі думали, що нас виселять.
The first year, nothing really happened. Everyone thought we would be evacuated as well. But then they left this village alone.
She never left. Nina said she and the other villagers didn't even know about the Chernobyl accident until a few weeks after it happened. It's unclear how many people used to live in Karpilka, but on this day there were only a few houses, a small road leading in and out of the village, and some apple trees still standing. There are no shops to buy food or other supplies. There's no public transportation available to nearby towns. She and other neighbors forage for their food in the surrounding fields and forests. While we're talking, a woman walks over to us. Her name is Maria, and she's the daughter of one of Nina's few remaining neighbors. She's driven here from Kiev to check on her mother. It turns out Maria is doing her own foraging and offers me what looks like blackberries she's just picked.
Yeah, take it, try it.
Sure.
Of course, I'm wondering if they're from the exclusion zone. I ask my translator to find out.
Where did they pick the berries from?
Звідки ви їх перебрали?
З зони.
From zone.
The zone. Yep, that's right.
Конечно, туди не дозволяють ходити.
No, yeah, they were stopping us. It's forbidden to go there.
Ну так просто там дырочку зробили і туди йдемо.
Ah, yeah, okay. We made a hole in the fence.
None of this seems to faze Nina, who has lived in this place her whole life. She says she could have moved to a larger city farther away from the Chernobyl accident. But the people who left and were exposed to radiation died anyway, and they died homesick.
Не хочу, буду тут і помирати. Лучшого там нема, тоже.
When they evacuated and relocated those villages, I visited some of those relatives. They were crying so much. They wanted to return home so much. They told me that if they would let them return, they would fly there on their wings. Even more of them died over there. But we are so fortunate, thank God. People are falling. I do not want to go anywhere. I would rather die here because it will not be good anywhere else at this age. I do not have the health for it.
As the few people left here continue to find a way to survive, government scientists say they're finally finishing their research on radiation levels near the exclusion zone. When they finish their report next year, they'll turn it over to the government, which will decide more than 30 years after the Chernobyl accident whether Nina and her few remaining neighbors will finally need to evacuate. For The World, I'm Alison Herrera, Kiev, Ukraine.
To see the village near the reactor where Nina lives, go to the Across Women's Lives Instagram page. The U.S. and Mexico have reached an agreement on trade. After months of negotiations, President Trump made the announcement today.
This is something that's very special for our manufacturers and for our farmers from both countries, for all of the people that work for jobs. It's also great trade, and it makes it a much more fair bill.
Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto thanked Trump for helping to make this deal possible, and both leaders say they want talks with Canada to start as soon as possible. Kendall Blust has been covering the story from Hermosillo, Sonora, in northern Mexico. She's with KJZZ Public Radio in Phoenix. How is this news going over in Mexico, Kendall?
It's an interesting time in Mexico. We're at a point of change of administrations. And so the incoming president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who will be starting in December, you know, his response to this is really important, too, because he'll be inheriting this, supposedly, you know, supposed to get signed in November. And his foreign minister has said that they're calling it a positive change. They see it as giving some short-term certainty for commerce and trade. The overall reaction is positive.
How do you think this changes relations between the U.S. and Mexico more generally?
In the last couple of years, it's been really, there's just been a lot of uncertainty. And that's been difficult in Mexico. It's lowered the value of the peso in relationship to the dollar. And we're already seeing that changing, that the value of the peso in relationship to the dollar has gone up today. And so I think it shows that people are feeling a little bit more stable. They feel like this relationship has some continuity to it, and that it just brings a sense of stability, of certainty that is helpful, I think, to both countries.
So President Trump says he's against NAFTA and he wants to get rid of it. Others believe NAFTA is actually the framework even for this new deal. So how much will things actually change? Are the details just changing in the margins, or do you see this as a sea change for the trade relationship between Mexico and the U.S.?
Seeing it from here and from what I've seen and heard, it's kind of a more of a continuation than a sea change. You know, these relationships have a long history, especially here in the North. And none of the things that we're talking about at the moment are a huge shift from what we've seen before. Whether President Trump is calling it NAFTA or wants to give it a new name, it does seem like it's the same deal overall.
Finally, Kendall, there's Canada, the missing link, if you will. There will be more negotiations with Canada, even though Trump threatened Canada today in his comments saying he'd hit them with new auto tariffs. Has Mexico been negotiating with Canada on the side?
There have been talks between Mexican leaders and Canada. Here in Mexico, there has been a push to make sure Canada stays involved and remains part of this deal.
Kendall Blust with KJZZ Public Radio in Phoenix, speaking with us from Hermosillo in Sonora in northern Mexico. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Looking at another few 90-plus degree days here in Boston before the end of August, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will fuel climate change for decades to come. As if that's not enough, here's another downside. It's going to make the food we eat less nutritious.
There's a direct effect of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere on plants that's reducing crop nutrients.
That's Harvard scientist Sam Myers. He co-wrote a study published today in the journal Nature Climate Change. It found that hundreds of millions of people could suffer from iron, zinc, and protein deficiencies in the coming decades. And that's because more carbon means fewer nutrients in staple crops around the world.
We're seeing on the order of roughly 5 to 15% reductions in these very important nutrients, including iron and zinc and protein.
5 to 15%, you said?
Uh-huh.
Is that a lot?
Well, yeah, it turns out that it is. But the only way to answer that question in a rigorous way is to ask, how many people in the world are living relatively close to a threshold of nutrient deficiency and are also depending on these kinds of food crops for significant portions of the nutrients that they're getting? And what we found is somewhere on the order of 100 to 200 million people around the world would be expected to fall into new risk of zinc and protein deficiency, and that there'd be large, large numbers of people that would lose important amounts of their dietary iron as well.
Which crops are we talking about here?
Well, the crops that provide most of the calories in the human diet, I mean, things like wheat and rice and soy and just about every crop that falls into what's called a C3 crop, which essentially is every single food crop that we eat except for maize or corn, sorghum, and some of the millets.
And I know you kind of separate the effect of CO2 on plants and CO2 in the atmosphere, but it is striking that the people who are going to feel these effects the most are the same people who are going to be most impacted overall by climate change, people in the Asian subcontinent, Southeast Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Why is that?
There's no question that the most vulnerable people in the world tend to be the poorest people in lower income countries who have the fewest sort of insulating layers to protect them from these effects, whether we're talking about more extreme storms or we're talking about increased exposure to infectious disease or we're talking about less nutritional foods. In this case, the greatest risk is in India, South Asia, much of Africa. And the reason for that is that those are places where diets are less diverse. 80% of calories in India's diet come from cereals. And relatively low-income people tend to have much lower intake of animal source foods, which are rich in iron, zinc, and protein, and can protect those people to some degree from these effects. So it's not very diverse diets, not very much animal source foods, heavy reliance on cereals, and then those cereals are losing key nutrients.
Sam, did this study personally worry you?
Yeah. I mean, it worries me that hundreds of millions of people are going to be pushed into new risk of some pretty serious nutritional deficits, but I also think there's an awful lot we can do. So I think we need to step up our commitment to doing research to reduce our vulnerability to these kinds of effects.
Sam, give us a bit of hope here. Are there fixes for this problem that crop researchers or public health officials are already thinking about?
You know, there are a variety of things we can do. I mean, obviously, first and foremost, we need to start reducing our carbon dioxide emissions. That's the most direct thing that we can do. But in addition to that, there are all kinds of other areas for research that could be engaged in. One is breeding crops that are actually less sensitive to this carbon dioxide effect. There's work being done in biofortification of crops, meaning that you enrich those crops with respect to certain nutrients or supplementing diets. There's an enormous amount that can be done, particularly in the most vulnerable countries, to encouraging increased consumption of foods like fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and legumes that would provide additional amounts of these nutrients. So there are all kinds of promising and interesting areas for research, but I think we really need to step up our commitment to doing that research, where right now I think the global commitment is relatively tepid.
Sam Myers, head of the Planetary Health Alliance and a researcher at Harvard School of Public Health. Thanks for being with us.
All right. Thank you so much.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.